Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein again for another conversation. Today we have Professor Mark Movsesyan, who is Professor of Contract Law at St. John's University and Director of the Center for Law and Religion, and our readers know you already, Mark. So you've been on a podcast and you've written for us several times, in fact. And today we're going to take the legal issue of the moment, and that is the Judge Kavanaugh nomination. And why don't you just go ahead and jump right in and tell us where that stands today?
Well, thanks, Mark. Where it stands is, I was reading the other day on the web, in the New York Times website, that the Kavanaugh nomination is the most partisan nomination that's ever been polled before. What do I mean by that? I mean that when they poll people, voters, about what they think about the Kavanaugh nomination, the results show a much greater partisan divide than we've ever seen before when they've done these polls. So I think something like 82% of Republicans say they support Judge Kavanaugh, and something like 67% of Democrats say they oppose Judge Kavanaugh. So really, it shows how the nomination process for Supreme Court justices has become really, frankly, just a partisan thing at this point, sadly.
And people don't know that much about Judge Kavanaugh yet. It's pretty early in the process for such a division to set in.
Yeah.
And I mean, he hasn't even appeared in the hearings yet.
No, well, this is all set up from the beginning. You know, right before his nomination, right before we knew who the nominee was, people were interviewing protesters on the steps of the Supreme Court, and they had signs saying stop and then blank. So whoever it was, I've actually written about this for the website. There's sort of a dance now when it comes to Supreme Court nominations. The dance is when a Republican president nominates someone, there are interest groups lined up, and the script is to say something like, this nominee is outside the mainstream, extreme, you know, frightening views, cue the scary music. Whoever the nominee is, really, this is just the dance that happens.
And the letter from Yale alumni and the students said, people will die.
Yes, you know, it's funny, I saw that, people will die. I saw that, and I remember, your listeners should know, I clerked for the Supreme Court. I clerked for David Souter, who turned out to be something of a surprise for the Bush administration. But I distinctly remember in the summer of 1990 in Washington, seeing protesters with signs that said, stop Souter now or women will die. So as I say, this is just the kind of script that gets brought out every nomination, really since the 1980s, really since the Bork nomination in 1987.
That changed everything.
That really did change everything. You know, before Bork, well, I mean, there weren't even hearings for nominees before the 1920s, and they didn't really become a regular part of the process till the 50s. And even then, they were sort of informal, you know, rather desultory.
Judge
affairs.
Scalia went through, was it 99-1 or
yeah.
99-0? I can't remember
right.
if there was...
Right, and you know, there's a great picture of him in his hearing smoking a pipe and just kind of talking, very relaxed. I mean, these were very different things before the Bork nomination.
Right.
And you remember, the Bork nomination was, you know, huge public relations campaign against him. Gregory Peck recorded advertisements against him. It was a huge thing. And that really did change it. Now why did that change everything? Because it worked. Because in stopping Robert Bork, the left eventually got Anthony Kennedy, and that had a huge difference, you know, for the next 30 years with regard to especially unenumerated rights, privacy issues. It was a huge victory. So the reason why the process has become what it is and stayed that way, is because it works, or can work.
I was told by someone in the Reagan administration that when that happened, They were caught absolutely by surprise. They had no idea that this was coming. And the Teddy Kennedy speech threw the White House into a complete uproar. And they had no plan. They had no response to it at first. And I think they turned it over to Bork to present himself
right.
at the hearings. And that's where I think a lot of the public sentiment came down, because Judge Bork, he wasn't playing to the camera very well, right? Because he wasn't that kind of person.
Correct. No. And you're right. I think that was an entirely new thing. I don't think people ever expected something like that. And I think, by all accounts, the White House was caught off guard. And of course, Robert Bork was himself not a very cooperative nominee. He apparently didn't do any hearing rehearsals. He didn't do any murder boards. So, but you know, I said a second ago it works, and I don't want to suggest that they're able to stop nominees this way. But it works in the sense that they did stop Robert Bork, and also they've affected the course of nominations since then, because, you know, every every Republican administration, if it doesn't have a Republican Senate, has to calculate whether this is going to happen again and whether the nominee will get through. And even this one, look, I mean, if we want to talk just basic partisan politics, the Republicans have like a one vote majority right now in the Senate. And if anyone peels off, someone like Susan Collins, a more moderate Republican, then the nominee goes down. And so people have to be prepared for that now.
Right, right. I noticed Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed by a sweeping majority, correct? I can't remember what the vote was. Did she get more than 90?
I don't recall what the vote was, but it certainly wasn't.
It wasn't close.
No, it wasn't close.
At all.
Right.
Which, now would you say that that shows that the Republican side didn't learn its lesson?
No,
from the Bork affair and after the Democrats, I don't want to get too partisan here, but that the Democrats played hardball in a way that the Republicans did not.
Well, no, I don't think so, Mark. In so far as the Democrats controlled the Senate in 1987 when Robert Bork was nominated, so they had the votes. And when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was nominated, the Democrats controlled the Senate, so the Republicans didn't have the votes. Now, In those days, the Republicans could have filibustered her, but they can no longer, by the way, the minority can no longer filibuster a Supreme Court nominee after last year. Well, no. Harry Reid said no more filibusters for appellate court nominees. And then when Neil Gorsuch was nominated in 2017, McConnell and the Republican senators, once it was clear that Gorsuch was not going to get any Democratic support, when it was clear Democrats were really going to oppose him and prevent the nominee from being considered, then they ended the filibuster. Republicans ended the filibuster. So no more filibusters. So look, I suppose that Republicans could have filibustered Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and for that matter, Stephen Breyer. They didn't do that. It would not have been traditional for them to do something like that. I think what you see happening here actually is, over time, it's like any other conflict. It gets worse and worse and worse unless it stops. And so people keep escalating things. You know, now we no longer have a filibuster. It's not allowed anymore for Supreme Court nominees.
Mm-hmm.
Because why? Because it was plain Democrats were willing to filibuster Gorsuch pretty much on partisan grounds. I mean, to be fair, look, and they would say, but Republicans prevented Merrick Garland from being considered under Obama, so it was Republicans who did this. And Republicans would say, well, that's because we know what you would do if you were in charge here. So each side points a finger at the other, and the conflict just escalates. And let me add one more thing here, Mark, which is the reason why these fights are getting so bitter, I think, reflects two facts about the court. And one fact is that everybody now understands that when it comes to cases like same-sex marriage or abortion or religious liberty, that these cases are turning on the philosophies and intuitions and general worldviews of the individual justices, that it really is not being determined by constitutional text.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So everybody knows that it matters a great deal who the justice is, and it matters a great deal what the justice's philosophy is, what the nominee's views on religious liberty are. This makes a big difference because these are essentially political determinations the court is making. So that's one reason why things have become so bitter. And I trace that right back to the court's unenumerated rights jurisprudence. You know, for 30 years, the court has decided these cases in ways that make plain the worldviews of the justices really make a difference. And so people understand that now, and that's why these fights are so protracted and so bitter. That's one reason. And the other reason is the court is pretty evenly divided right now. You know, in these cases, one can predict pretty easily where the justices are going to come down.
Mm-hmm.
We know there are going to be four justices taking a liberal or progressive view, and there are going to be four justices taking a more conservative view, and Justice Kennedy is right in the middle. And so it's not simply spite or obstinacy or the law of escalation of conflict that explains what's going on. There are genuine reasons why people care a lot about this and fight very hard about it.
On Kavanaugh's acculturation, as you sort of suggested about it, what he believes, you said you've looked at some of the issues that might turn on religious liberty. What are the issues that Kavanaugh has weighed in on, pertinent to that field?
Yeah, well, I had a chance to look at his religious liberty cases, and so I'm glad we'll focus on that. I don't want to talk more about his other cases. I don't want to pretend to have a deep knowledge of those. But I did look at his religious liberty cases, and I think, looking at, it's a very sparse record. We don't have too much of a record. He's only written a couple of opinions in the area. He has joined other judges in opinions in church-state issues, but I'm never sure what to make of that, Mark. I mean, because although joining another judge's opinion shows you agree with the reasoning, they really aren't your words, and so I'm not sure how much you can draw from those. He has represented religious claimants pro bono when he was in private practice. For example, he in the Santa Fe case involving prayer at public high school graduations, he represented the one might say the pro-religion side of this. And so that suggests a general sympathy with that position, although you have to be careful about attributing to a judge the positions that he takes when he's a lawyer. They're two different things. As a lawyer, you advocate for your client. As a judge, you're deciding as a neutral arbiter.
But he took the case.
He did, and people in the religious freedom advocacy community speak well of him. And the other caveat I'd say is we're looking at his record as an appellate judge. And as an appellate judge, and Judge Kavanaugh has made this point more than once, one's job is to try to understand what the Supreme Court would do if presented with this case. And so as an appellate judge, you know,
that's the perspective as an appellate judge.
As an appellate judge, and he has said so. He has said in his opinions, you know, it's not our job to expand a ruling of the Supreme Court or to take away from the ruling of a Supreme Court. Our job is to do what we think the Supreme Court would like us to do in a case like this.
Based upon precedents that Correct. The court has made. For instance, one thing the court did after Masterpiece Cake Shop, correct, was to send the state of Washington florist case back to the Washington Supreme
Correct.
Court. And the Washington Supreme Court can't then ignore what the court ruled in Masterpiece. You must take this into account. And if you don't, well, this is, you know, just a side point. What if the Washington State Supreme Court just come back and reiterates its prior opinion?
Well, then the Supreme Court could reverse it on constitutional grounds, and then it goes back to the state of Washington, and the Washington Supreme Court is then supposed to issue judgment in accordance with the Supreme Court opinions.
Okay. Now, because the Supreme Court voided, is that the legal term? Voided
vacated.
The Washington State decision.
Yeah, they vacated it, sent it back, and said, I think that's what happened. But to your broader question, no, the lower courts, including the state Supreme Courts in federal constitutional questions, our tradition now is that they have to go along with the Supreme Court rulings. And we've had a civil war about this, among other matters, about whether state courts had to go along, but that is what most people would say today. And that this does get us a little far afield into
sure.
Supreme Court practice.
Sure, so back to Kavanaugh. He took up the case for a high school student who wanted to pray?
He did.
Is that okay?
Well, a high school student who wanted to have prayer at high school football games, not graduations, the high school football games. And he took up the case pro bono on that side. But my point is that everything I'm going to say is, you know, there are a few caveats. One is we just don't have a lot of information, and the best information we have is his opinions as an appellate court judge, where he was trying as best he could to do what he thought the Supreme Court would want him to do as an appellate judge. All that being said, I mean, the bottom line, I think, is that he's likely to be a conservative judge on the conservative side of things, but I don't think he's likely to be a radical conservative or a kind of bomb thrower in the way maybe some conservatives would hope or some liberals would fear. I think he's going to be kind of right in the middle of where the law is at this point.
But before going to that, let me come back. You mentioned before we started that he had weighed in on a kind of Hobby Lobby case.
Yes, he did. So he has
a judge.
Yes, he has written two opinions in the area. One of them in what we would call free exercise in the free. So let me go back a step. So when we talk about religion clause jurisprudence, church and state jurisprudence, there really are two sides, two main issues in church and state relations in the U.S. One category is establishment clause issues. These are cases that talk about whether the government has established a religion in violation of the First Amendment. And the other big category is free exercise cases. And this is where the question is, has the government interfered with a person's free exercise of his or her religion? And Judge Kavanaugh has written opinions in both of those areas, one in each of them. So, Hobby Lobby. So that's the free exercise side. Now, Hobby Lobby, that all this involved the contraception mandate, and maybe I should give some background to your listeners because it's an extremely complicated set of litigation, and people need to know a little bit about it.
Sure.
Even as someone who studies this for a living, I find this stuff confusing to keep track of sometimes. So basically, The contraception mandate is under the Affordable Care Act, and basically it was promulgated by the Obama administration. And the basic idea is that employers have to provide cost-free contraception coverage for their women employees, or they have to pay a big fine. There was an opt-out, and this was only after a lot of wrangling, but the Obama administration provided an opt-out for religious nonprofits. If they objected to covering contraception, they didn't have to. They had to file a form with their insurer that said they would not provide this coverage, and then the insurer had to provide it without any cost to the women employees. That's for religious nonprofits. For-profit corporations had to do it under the contraception mandate. There was no opt-out for them. Okay. The Hobby Lobby case involved a for-profit corporation which said it did not want to provide coverage for a few contraceptives on the list because the owners of the corporation had religious convictions that some of these were abortion-inducing drugs. In the Hobby Lobby case, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, said that requiring the for-profit corporations to provide this coverage violated a statute called RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Now, RFRA says that the government cannot substantially burden a person's exercise of religion unless the government has a compelling interest in applying the law to that person and the government has no lesser restrictive means, that is, the least restrictive means of promoting that compelling interest. Okay, so in Hobby Lobby, the court said, well, the contraception mandate substantially burdened the exercise of religion by these for-profit corporations, okay? The Hobby Lobby court then said, assuming the government has a compelling interest in providing cost-free contraception to women employees of these employers, assuming for the sake of argument there is that compelling interest, still the government hadn't chosen the least restrictive means. Because why? Because they said, well, you can give these for-profit corporations the same opt-out you gave the religious nonprofits. You could have the for-profit corporations file a note with the insurer saying we don't want to do this, and then the insurer can do it, and that would be a less restrictive means of promoting that presumptively compelling interest in providing contraception. So that's Hobby Lobby. That's the background of the contraception mandate. Now let's get to Judge Kavanaugh and his opinion. So Judge Kavanaugh's opinion is in a case involving a group called the Priests for Life, which is a religious nonprofit. And the Priests for Life said, well, the contraception mandate violates our free exercise because even the opt-out you have given us is not enough. Because in our view, writing the note to the insurer saying we don't want to cover this is still making us complicit in the coverage of contraception because we all know what's going to happen. We know when we tell the insurer will just pay for it. So we are still complicit. The opt-out is not good enough. It's still, okay. So this went to the DC Circuit. A panel of the DC Circuit said, Priests for Life, you lose because, frankly, we just don't think this is a substantial burden on your religious exercise. All you have to do is you file a form and you're not a part of this anymore and, you know, this is just not a burden. Okay. So then the Priests for Life, among other reasons, then the Priests for Life sued for rehearing. They wanted the entire DC Circuit, not just the panel, to hear the case. It's called rehearing en banc. The court denied rehearing en banc and said, no, we're not going to, you had a panel decision, the whole court is not going to reconsider this. Judge Kavanaugh wrote a dissent to the denial of rehearing en banc. And he said, actually, this is a violation of RFRA with respect to the Priests for Life. Why? First, he said, it is not for a civil court to question whether something is a substantial burden on someone's religion. If the plaintiff is sincere and says, according to my religious views, this is a burden on my religious exercise, then the courts have to defer to that. Because it's not for a civil court to decide whether someone is complicit in wrongdoing on the basis of his religious convictions.
You're gonna tell these priests what their doctrine really is.
Correct, and he says, you can't do that, number one. Then remember, now RFRA says, the government cannot substantially burden religious exercise unless the government has a compelling interest in applying the law to the person and there's no lesser restrictive means of doing so. Okay, so Judge Kavanaugh said, this is a substantial burden. It's not for us to question. And then he said, it's pretty strongly suggested by the Supreme Court's opinion in Hobby Lobby that there is a compelling governmental interest in providing cost-free coverage for contraception for the women employee women employees of these religious nonprofits. And this is where he got in trouble with some conservatives. Because I have to say, his rulings on religious freedom have drawn controversy. They've drawn complaints both from the left and from the right, which is something maybe First Things listeners want to know about. I'll get into explaining this in a minute. But he said, I think there's likely the Supreme Court would say there's a compelling interest here. But this is still not the least restrictive means. The government could have done something else. The government could have just covered the contraceptives itself, right? So you could have a system in which the priest for life just tell the government, we object to this, not the insurer. Tell the government we object to this, and then the priest for life are out of it, and then the government can just provide contraceptives on its own, or the government can tell the insurer to do it. At that point, and the priest for life said, we don't think we'd be complicit, or there's some indication in the record we wouldn't think we're complicit in something like that.
So I just have a quick question. If you're working for Priest for Life and you want to use contraceptives or abortion, and the organization you work for firmly, fundamentally disagrees with this, why do you want to work for that organization? This is a bigger question,
obviously.
That's
a bigger question, right.
Can that organization say, you can't work here?
That gets us into a whole other... Let's put it like this. They were not doing that. They weren't making that claim, in this case, the Priest for Life. They weren't saying you can't work here. They just said, we don't want to pay for this. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me explain. So this was what Judge Kavanaugh said. Now, let me explain to you what the controversy about this decision is. From the left, it's very easy. The left says, look, this is an example of Judge Kavanaugh. He's extreme. He's outside the mainstream. He wants to establish Christian privilege in the law. He's preventing women from getting contraceptives, et cetera, et cetera. That's all to be expected because that's part of the dance, as I told you. This is part of just the nominee, right, okay. But this has also caused some concern on the part of conservatives. Why? Because they think that Judge Kavanaugh reached out to say something he didn't really have to say to decide this case. It is true in the case, he came down in favor of the Priest for Life, and you would say that is conservative insofar as he is supporting a religious claimant who says, I can't do this kind of thing. But let's come back to this compelling interest argument that he made. So remember, what he said in the case was, when I read Hobby Lobby, I think the court strongly hinted that there's a compelling interest the government has in providing cost-free coverage for contraceptives for women who are in this situation. Now the critique would be this. He didn't really have to say that. In fact, he said a little further. He said
he could have dissented without even bringing that up.
Well, no, he could have said this. He could have said, let's assume for the sake of argument that there's a compelling interest here. Still, this is not the least restrictive means. That's what the Supreme Court actually did in Hobby Lobby. In fact, his reading of Hobby Lobby is a sort of aggressive reading of Hobby Lobby when it comes to the compelling interest. They really didn't say, and I think he concedes this, the Supreme Court in Hobby Lobby didn't say expressly there's a compelling interest. They said, let's assume there's a compelling interest for the sake of argument. Mm-hmm. Still, the government loses. He went a little further. He said, I think they really think there's a compelling interest. And then he even said, he had another paragraph saying, and it's easy to see why this would be a compelling interest, because unintended pregnancies cause a lot of problems for women. It can cause health problems. It can interfere with their professional opportunities. We can see why this would be a compelling governmental interest. Okay, he didn't really have to say that to resolve the case. In fact, there's another dissent in the case, another conservative dissent from the denial of rehearing, written by Judge Brown. And Judge Brown says there is no compelling governmental interest here because all these women will be able to get cost-free contraception anyway with just some additional administrative hurdle. So there's another conservative dissent in the case that says there's not a compelling interest here. So conservatives look at this, some conservatives have looked at this and said, well, what's going on here? You really didn't have to say this. Mm-hmm. Why did he do it? I don't know how much you can make of that. I mean, I think in the end, Judge Kavanaugh did come down on the side of, you might say, conservatives who support religious freedom. But it's not an entirely trivial objection. Because it does suggest, I think, and this is why I said a while ago, I think Judge Kavanaugh will be a centrist conservative, not a kind of radical conservative. Because his discussion of compelling interest, on the one hand, you could say he's just doing what he's supposed to do. This is his best reading of Hobby Lobby. He's trying to understand what the Supreme Court would do. He also may have been trying to write a little petition to the Supreme Court for when they hear the case. Like, here's an analysis you can use. If if you think there's a compelling interest, you can still come along this way.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, compelling interest has never been defined. What is a compelling interest depends a lot on the intuitions of particular judges.
Where does the term compelling interest
come from? It's in the law. It's in the statute. It's in RFRA.
It's in RFRA.
It's in RFRA, but it comes also from case law before RFRA. But the court has never defined what compelling interest really means, and much turns on the intuitions of the individual judge. So what you could say from this is, it shows that Judge Kavanaugh may have at least some progressive leanings on these questions, that he wrote it this way. It certainly doesn't suggest a doctrinaire, quote-unquote, scary conservative that should be frightening people. He's sort of right in the middle, I think, of where the law is at this point.
Do you think that will come off in the hearings? His more moderate conservatism?
Well, I think the Republicans on the committee would have an interest in bringing this up to blunt arguments from the left, which are undoubtedly going to happen, that he's anti-woman, whatever. If you're trying to persuade Susan Collins, you can certainly bring this up and say, look, you know, he's written about how the government likely has a compelling interest because unintended pregnancies can have deleterious effects on women. If one is trying to appeal to a kind of moderate / liberal Republican, this mm-hmm. is just the sort of language you could point to.
Collins and Lisa Murkowski, they're holding quiet about this until the hearings.
If I were trying to persuade them, I would certainly point to this.
You know, there was an article in the Boston Globe. I was up in Boston reading the Boston Globe. It was a profile of Kavanaugh while he was at Harvard. Kavanaugh was a visiting professor there for 10 years. And they went through, they talked to professors there, they talked to alumni who took his classes. Universal praise. They're all liberal. They loved him there. The students loved him, the faculty said, of course we knew he was a conservative, but he loved the debate. He loved talking with liberal students. He would meet with them afterwards. He'd go to the cafeteria and sit down with them. And it showed, I think, part of those personability factors that will play very well on camera.
This comes through in his opinions too. He is scrupulously fair to the other side. He goes out of his way to express respect for judges on the other side and for litigants against whom he is ruling. We can talk about the other case. I want to talk about the inauguration case, Newdow versus Roberts. I think, you know, the atmospherics of his opinions are, they're, look, certainly conservative, but I would say centrist conservative. Really, you wonder in some sense, I mean, who do Democrats think they're going to get from a Republican administration? They're not going to get a liberal judge. And really, this is, you know, this is pretty good from their perspective, I think, assuming they're going to get a conservative, which is what's going to happen.
What is the inauguration case?
Okay, this is a different case. Now, this case involves the other half of church and state law, Establishment Clause cases. Establishment Clause cases are about whether the government has established a religion in violation of the First Amendment. So Newdow involved a plaintiff who's an atheist. Actually, it's Michael Newdow, who's sort of famous for going around suing about
religions. Yes.
You know,
yes,
Michael Newdow.
Yes.
Okay. So Newdow sued, and he said that the 2009 inauguration of President Obama violated the Establishment Clause. Because why? First, he objected to the words, so help me God, in the presidential oath. And second, he objected to the presence of prayers on the program. And so he sued to enjoin an official use of so help me God and also prayers at the inauguration. The D.C. Circuit ruled against him, and the D.C. Circuit said he had no standing, which is a legal procedural matter. They didn't get to the merits of his claim. They said, you have not stated an injury that we can redress. First of all, the 2009 inauguration is over. So it's now moot whether that violated the Constitution or not. And anyway, what you're really asking us is to enjoin anybody who might take part in an inauguration at any point in the future. We don't know what's going to happen in the next inaugurations. It's just kind of unworkable. We can't give you any redress, so you lose on standing grounds. Kavanaugh concurred in the judgment. He concurred in the judgment. He said, well, actually, I think under Supreme Court precedent, there is standing here because although the Supreme Court has never expressly stated there would be standing in a case like this, they have handled a lot of cases in which people have objected to prayer at public ceremonies, and they've never said there's a problem with standing. So probably they would say there is standing in a case like this. So we have to get to the merits of the claim. And then Judge Kavanaugh said, on the merits, there is no Establishment Clause violation here. This is very interesting, how he works. He said, first of all, he said, look, the Establishment Clause jurisprudence is kind of vague. There's not a uniform test here. The closest case, he said, is a case called Marsh versus Chambers, which is about legislative prayer. And he said, based on that case, I think, so help me God, in the oath, and prayers at the presidential inauguration are constitutional. Why? Principally because they are deeply rooted in the nation's history and tradition. They have been a part of the nation's history and tradition from time immemorial, and that counts a lot with regard to the constitutionality of a practice like this.
Otherwise, for 230 years, we've been violating the Constitution.
Correct.
And everyone has been violating the Constitution, that's including the founders.
That's what he said. So this, I think, is very significant, this case, actually. Why? Well, first of all, it does show, again, he's a conservative, because supporting public religious statements or religious statements at public events is now a conservative position. He came down in favor of it. And he came down in favor of it. Mark, you're a participant in our tradition project. This will, from my center, this will appeal to you. He said it's constitutional largely because it is part of our history and tradition, which for my sort of conservative, and I will say your sort of conservative, that's great, right? To look to tradition, to look to the nation's history.
This tendency to treat legal questions in this abstraction, neutralizing everything that has come before, we're just treating it in theoretical terms. I think this is a terribly damaging way to proceed. Anyone who believes in tradition knows this.
And in this, I would say this opinion suggests he is a true judicial conservative in a way that I would endorse. I think many of the first things listeners would endorse. It's important for a couple of other reasons too. One is it's uncanny when I read this. He almost exactly predicted the approach the Supreme Court took a few years later in a different case. In 2014, a case called Town of Greece versus Galloway.
It's in New York State.
New York State. It was a legislative prayer case, and the Supreme Court ruled that legislative prayer was constitutional largely because it was part of the nation's history and tradition. They also said, as long as it is not proselytizing, which is exactly what Judge Kavanaugh said in this case. He said, I think that these prayers are consistent with what the Supreme Court has said. They are constitutional as long as they are not proselytizing, that is, aggressively, you know, seeking to convert someone or talking about how great your religion is and so on. In other words, sectarian prayers are okay as long as they are not overly aggressive. That's what Judge Kavanaugh said in 2010 in this D.C. Circuit case. That's just what the Supreme Court said in 2014 without attributing it to him. I looked it up. They didn't say this is what Judge Kavanaugh said. That opinion is by Justice Anthony Kennedy. So I think, you know, once again, you can say Kavanaugh clearly understood where the court was and wrote it in a way that obviously reflected the court's thinking, including the thinking of his mentor, Justice Anthony Kennedy. So he gets a lot of credit for that.
Was that decision a bit of a surprise?
His decision?
The town.
Town
of Greece.
No, I don't think it was a surprise because the court has been so vague about what's an Establishment Clause violation or what isn't. I'll say it was a 5-4 decision. So it was a close decision.
Well, I've heard atheists, advocates, secularists say many times how obviously a violation, things such as opening Congress with a prayer, how this is just, this isn't even arguable, and that inevitably we're just going to get past this tradition and step into what the Constitution really says about such things. And the recourse to tradition strikes them as just, we don't do that.
Yeah, well, the court...
We don't do that.
The court doesn't always do that, but and often the court does step away from our tradition with regard to these questions, but not with regard to legislative prayer. And Judge Kavanaugh saw that and wrote an opinion which very closely predicted what was going to happen. I also should say that in this opinion, he goes out of his way to express respect for Michael Newdow and says, look, atheists are American citizens too, and we have to treat their arguments fairly and their objections have merit. But he said, on the other hand, there are also many Americans who do want to hear prayers at these events, and their views must be taken seriously also. Which again is why I will repeat, I mean, I think looking at least at his church and state cases, you would say that Judge Kavanaugh is a conservative, but a centrist conservative, a conservative who's kind of sort of in the middle of where things are right now, not extreme. You know, some First Things readers might have hoped for a more radical conservative judge, and I'm sure many liberals would fear a more radical conservative judge. I don't think, based on his church and state jurisprudence, that's what we have here. I think we have a centrist conservative.
Thank you for that summation. Professor Movsesyan, we'll have to have you again pretty soon.
Glad to be here.